Trent's Last Case by E.C. Bentley. The Woman in Black. Chapter 1. Bad News. Between what matters and what seems to matter, how should the world we know judge wisely? When the scheming, indomitable brain of Sigsby Manderson was scattered by a shot from an unknown hand, that world lost nothing worth a single tear. It gained something memorable in a harsh reminder of the vanity of such wealth as this dead man had piled up. Without making one loyal friend to mourn him, without doing an act that could help his memory to the least honor. But when the news came of his end, it seemed to those living in the great vortices of business as if the earth, too, shuddered under a blow. In all the lurid commercial history of his country, there had been no figure that had so imposed itself upon the mind of the trading world. He had a niche apart in its temples. Financial giants, strong to direct and augment the forces of capital, and taking an approved toll in millions for their labor, had existed before. But in the case of Manderson, there'd been this singularity, that a pale halo of piratical romance, a thing especially dear to the hearts of his countrymen, had remained incongruously about his head through the years when he stood in every eye as the unquestioned guardian of stability, the stamper-out of manipulated crises, the foe of the raiding chieftains that infest the borders of Wall Street. The fortune left by his grandfather, who'd been one of those chieftains on the smaller scale of his day, had descended to him with accretion through his father, who during a long life had quietly continued to lend money and never had margined a stock. Manderson, who had at no time known what it was to be without large sums to his hand, should have been altogether of that newer American plutocracy which is steadied by the tradition and habit of great wealth. But it was not so. While his nurture and education had taught him European ideas of a rich man's proper external circumstance, while they had rooted in him an instinct for quiet magnificence, the larger costliness which does not shriek of itself with a thousand tongues, there had been handed on to him, nevertheless, much of the 49er and financial buccaneer, his forebear. During that first period of his business career, which had been called his early bad manner, he'd been little more than a gambler of genius, his hand against every man's, an infant prodigy, who brought to the enthralling pursuit of speculation a brain better endowed than any that opposed it. At St. Helena, it was laid down that war is une belle occupation, and so the young Manderson had found the multitudinous and complicated dogfight of the Stock Exchange of New York. Then came his change. At his father's death, when Manderson was 30 years old, some new revelation of the power and the glory of the God he served seemed to have come upon him. With the sudden elastic adaptability of his nation, he turned to steady labor in his father's banking business, closing his ears to the sound of the battles of the street. In a few years, he came to control all the activity of the great firm whose unimpeached conservatism, safety, and financial weight lifted it like a cliff above the angry sea of the markets. All mistrust founded on the performances of his youth had vanished. He was quite plainly a different man. How the change came about, none could say with authority, but there was a story of certain last words spoken by his father, whom alone he had respected and perhaps loved. He began to tower above the financial situation. Soon his name was current in the bourses of the world. One who spoke the name of Manderson called up a vision of all that was broad-based and firm in the vast wealth of the United States. He planned great combinations of capital, drew together and centralized industries of continental scope, financed with unerring judgment the large designs of state or of private enterprise. Many a time when he took hold to smash a strike or to federate the ownership of some great field of labor, he sent ruin upon a multitude of tiny homes. And if miners or steelworkers or cattlemen defied him and invoked disorder, he could be more lawless and ruthless than they. But this was done in the pursuit of legitimate business ends. Tens of thousands of the poor might curse his name, but the financier and the speculator execrated him no more. He stretched a hand to protect or to manipulate the power of wealth in every corner of the country. Forcible, cold, and unerring, in all he did, he ministered to the national lust for magnitude, and a grateful country surnamed him the Colossus. But there was an aspect of Manderson in this later period that lay long unknown and unsuspected save by a few, his secretaries and lieutenants and certain of the associates of his bygone hurling time. This little circle knew that Manderson, the pillar of sound business and stability in the markets, had his hours of nostalgia for the lively times when the street had trembled at his name. It was, said one of them, as if Blackbeard had settled down as a decent merchant in Bristol on the spoils of the main. Now and then the pirate would glare suddenly out, the knife in his teeth, and the sulfur matches sputtering in his hatband. During such spasms of reversion to type, a score of tempestuous raids upon the market had been planned on paper in the inner room of the offices of Manderson, Colfax, and Company. But they were never carried out. Blackbeard would quell the mutiny of his old self within him and go soberly down to his counting house, humming a stave or two of Spanish Ladies, perhaps under his breath. Manderson would allow himself the harmless satisfaction, as soon as the time for action had gone by, of pointing out to some Rupert of the markets a coup worth a million to the depredator might have been made. "Seems to me," he would say almost wistfully, "the street's getting to be a mighty dull place since I quit." By slow degrees, this amiable weakness of the Colossus became known to the business world, which exulted greatly in the knowledge. At the news of his death, panic went through the markets like a hurricane, for it came at a luckless time. Prices tottered and crashed like towers in an earthquake. For 2 days, Wall Street was a clamorous inferno of pale despair. All over the United States, wherever speculation had its devotees, went a waft of ruin, a plague of suicide. In Europe also, not a few took with their own hands lives that had become pitiably linked to the destiny of a financier whom most of them had never seen. In Paris, a well-known banker walked quietly out of the Bourse and fell dead upon the broad steps among the raving crowd of Jews, a file crushed in his hand. In Frankfurt, one leapt from the cathedral top, leaving a redder stain where he struck the red tower. Men stabbed and shot and strangled themselves, drank death or breathed it as the air, because in a lonely corner of England, the life had departed from one cold heart vowed to the service of greed. The blow could not have fallen at a more disastrous moment. It came when Wall Street was in a condition of suppressed scare. Suppressed because for a week past, the great interests known to act with or to be actually controlled by the Colossus had been desperately combating the effects of the sudden arrest of Lucas Hahn and the exposure of his plundering of the Hahn banks. This bombshell, in its turn, had fallen at a time when the market had been boosted beyond its real strength. In the language of the place, a slump was due. Reports from the corn lands had not been good, and there had been 2 or 3 railway statements which had been expected to be much better than they were. But at whatever point in the vast area of speculation the shudder of the threatened break had been felt, the Manderson crowd had stepped in and held the market up. All through the week, the speculator's mind, as shallow as it is quick-witted, as sentimental as greedy, had seen in this the hand of the giant stretched out in protection from afar. Manderson, said the newspapers in chorus, was in hourly communication with his lieutenants in the street. One journal was able to give in round figures the sum spent on cabling between New York and Marlston in the past 24 hours. It told how a small staff of expert operators had been sent down by the post office authorities to Marlston to deal with the flood of messages. Another revealed that Manderson, on the first news of the Hahn crash, had arranged to abandon his holiday and return home by the Lusitania, but that he soon had the situation so well in hand that he had determined to remain where he was. All this was falsehood, more or less consciously elaborated by the finance editors, consciously initiated and encouraged by the shrewd businessmen of the Manderson Group, who knew that nothing could better help their plans than this illusion of hero worship, knew also that no word had come from Manderson in answer to their messages, and that Howard B. Jeffrey, of steel and iron fame, was the true organizer of victory. So they fought down apprehension through four feverish days, and minds grew calmer. On Saturday, though the ground beneath the feet of Mr. Jeffrey yet rumbled now and then with Etna mutterings of disquiet, he deemed his task almost done. The market was firm and slowly advancing. Wall Street turned to its sleep of Sunday, worn out, but thankfully at peace. In the first trading hour of Monday, a hideous rumor flew round the 60 acres of the financial district. It came into being as the lightning comes, a blink that seems to begin nowhere, though it is to be suspected that it was first whispered over the telephone, together with an urgent selling order by some employee in the cable service. A sharp spasm convulsed the convalescent share list. In 5 minutes, the dull noise of the curbstone market in Broad Street had leapt to a high note of frantic interrogation. From within the hive of the exchange itself could be heard a droning hubbub of fear, and men rushed, hatless, in and out. "Was it true?" asked every man. And every man replied, with trembling lips, that it was a lie put out by some unscrupulous short interest seeking to cover itself. In another quarter of an hour, news came of a sudden and ruinous collapse of Yankees in London at the close of the Stock Exchange day. It was enough. New York had still 4 hours trading in front of her. The strategy of pointing to Manderson as the savior and warden of the markets had recoiled upon its authors with annihilating force. And Jeffrey, his ear at his private telephone, listened to the tale of disaster with a set jaw. The new Napoleon had lost his Marengo. He saw the whole financial landscape sliding and falling into chaos before him. In half an hour, the news of the finding of Manderson's body, with the inevitable rumor that it was suicide, was printing in a dozen newspaper offices. But before a copy reached Wall Street, the tornado of the panic was in full fury, and Howard B. Jeffrey and his collaborators were whirled away like leaves before its breath. All this sprang out of nothing. Nothing in the texture of the general life had changed. The corn had not ceased to ripen in the fields. The rivers bore their barges and gave power to a myriad engines. The flocks fattened on the pastures. The herds were unnumbered. Men labored everywhere in the various servitudes to which they were born and chafed not more than usual in their bonds. Bellona tossed and murmured as ever, yet still slept her uneasy sleep. To all mankind, save a million or two of half-crazed gamblers, blind to all reality, the death of Manderson meant nothing. The life and work of the world went on. Weeks before he died, strong hands had been in control of every wire in the huge network of commerce and industry that he had supervised. Before his corpse was buried, his countrymen had made a strange discovery: that the existence of the potent engine of monopoly that went by the name of Sigsbee Manderson had not been a condition of even material prosperity. The panic blew itself out in 2 days. The pieces were picked up. The bankrupts withdrew out of sight. The market recovered a normal tone. While the brief delirium was yet subsiding, there broke out a domestic scandal in England that suddenly fixed the attention of two continents. Next morning, the Chicago Limited was wrecked, and the same day, a notable politician was shot down in cold blood by his wife's brother in the streets of New Orleans. Within a week of its rising, the Manderson story, to the trained sense of editors throughout the Union, was cold. The tide of American visitors pouring through Europe made eddies round the memorial or statue of many a man who died in poverty, and never thought of their most famous plutocrat. Like the poet who died in Rome, so young and poor, 100 years ago, he was buried far away from his own land. But for all the men and women of Manderson's people who flock round the tomb of Keats in the cemetery under the Monte Testaccio, there is not one, nor ever will be, to stand in reverence by the rich man's grave beside the little church of Marlstone. Chapter 2. Knocking the Town Endways. In the only comfortably furnished room in the offices of the Record, the telephone on Sir James Molloy's table buzzed. Sir James made a motion with his pen, and Mr. Silver, his secretary, left his work and came over to the instrument. "Who's that?" he said. "Who? I can't hear you. Oh, it's Mr. Bunner, is it? Yes, but I know, but he's fearfully busy this afternoon. Can't you? Oh, really? Well, in that case, just hold on, will you?" He placed the receiver before Sir James. "It's Calvin Bunner, Sigsbee Manderson's right-hand man," he said concisely. "He insists on speaking to you personally. Says it's the gravest piece of news. He's talking from the house down by Bishopsbridge, so it'll be necessary to speak clearly." Sir James looked at the telephone, not affectionately, and took up the receiver. "Well," he said, in his strong voice, and listened. "Yes," he said. The next moment, Mr. Silver, eagerly watching him, saw a look of amazement and horror. "Good God," he murmured. Clutching the instrument, he slowly rose to his feet, still bending ear intently. At intervals, he repeated, "Yes." Presently, as he listened, he glanced at the clock and spoke quickly to Mr. Silver over the top of the transmitter. "Go and hunt up Figgis and young Williams. Hurry." Mr. Silver darted from the room. The great journalist was a tall, strong, clever Irishman of 50, swart and black-mustached, a man of untiring business energy, well known in the world, which he understood very thoroughly, and played upon with the half-cynical competence of his race. Yet was he without a touch of the charlatan. He made no mysteries and no pretenses of knowledge, and he saw instantly through these and others. In his handsome, well-bred, well-dressed appearance, there was something a little sinister when anger or intense occupation put its imprint about his eyes and brow. But when his generous nature was under no restraint, he was the most cordial of men. He was managing director of the company which owned that most powerful morning paper, The Record, and also that most indispensable evening paper, The Sun, which had its offices on the other side of the street. He was, moreover, editor-in-chief of The Record, to which he had, in the course of years, attached the most variously capable personnel in the country. It was a maxim of his that where you could not get gifts, you must do the best you could with solid merit, and he employed a great deal of both. He was respected by his staff as few are respected in a profession not favorable to the growth of the sentiment of reverence. "You're sure that's all?" asked Sir James, after a few minutes of earnest listening and questioning. "And how long has this been known?" "Yes, of course. The police are. But the servants? Surely it's all over the place down there by now." "Well, we'll have to try. Look here, Bunner. I'm infinitely obliged to you about this. I owe you a good turn. You know I mean what I say. Come and see me the first day you get to town." "All right, that's understood. Now I must act on your news. Goodbye." Sir James hung up the receiver and seized a railway timetable from the rack before him. After a rapid consultation of this oracle, he flung it down with a forcible word as Mr. Silver hurried into the room, followed by a hard-featured man with spectacles and a youth with an alert eye. "I want you to jot down some facts, Figgis," said Sir James, banishing all signs of agitation and speaking with a rapid calmness. "When you have them, put them into shape just as quick as you can for a special edition of the Sun." The hard-featured man nodded and glanced at the clock, which pointed to a few minutes past 3. He pulled out a notebook and drew a chair up to the big writing table. "Silver," Sir James went on, "go and tell Jones to wire our local correspondent very urgently to drop everything and get down to Marlston at once. He's not to say why in the telegram. There must not be an unnecessary word about this news until the Sun is on the streets with it. You all understand? Williams, cut across the way and tell Mr. Anthony to hold himself ready for a 2-column opening that will knock the town endways. Just tell him that he must take all measures and precautions for a scoop. Say that Figgis will be over in 5 minutes with the facts, and that he had better let him write up the story in his private room. As you go, ask Miss Mormon to see me here at once, and tell the telephone people to see if they can get Mr. Trent on the wire for me. After seeing Mr. Anthony, return here and stand by." The alert-eyed young man vanished like a spirit. Sir James turned instantly to Mr. Figgis, whose pencil was poised over the paper. "Sigsby Manderson has been murdered," he began quickly and clearly, pacing the floor with his hands behind him. Mr. Figgis scratched down a line of shorthand with as much emotion as if he had been told that the day was fine, the pose of his craft. "He and his wife and 2 secretaries have been for the past fortnight at the house called White Gables at Marlston, near Bishopsbridge. He bought it 4 years ago. He and Mrs. Manderson have since spent a part of each summer there. Last night he went to bed about 11:30, just as usual. No one knows when he got up and left the house. He was not missed until this morning. About 10 o'clock, his body was found by a gardener. It was lying by a shed in the grounds. He was shot in the head, through the left eye. Death must have been instantaneous. The body was not robbed, but there were marks on the wrists which pointed to a straggle having taken place. Dr. Stock of Marlston was at once sent for, and will conduct the post-mortem examination. The police from Bishopsbridge, who were soon on the spot, are reticent, but it's believed that they're quite without a clue to the identity of the murderer. There you are, Figgis. Mr. Anthony is expecting you. Now, I must telephone him and arrange things." Mr. Figgis looked up. "One of the ablest detectives at Scotland Yard," he suggested, "has been put in charge of the case. It's a safe statement." "If you like," said Sir James. "And Mrs. Manderson, was she there?" "Yes, what about her?" "Prostrated by the shock," hinted the reporter, "and sees nobody. Human interest." "I wouldn't put that in, Mr. Figgis," said a quiet voice. It belonged to Miss Morgan, a pale, graceful woman, who had silently made her appearance while the dictation was going on. "I've seen Mrs. Manderson," she proceeded, turning to Sir James. "She looks quite healthy and intelligent. Has her husband been murdered? I don't think the shock would prostrate her. She's more likely to be doing all she can to help the police." "Something in your own style, then, Miss Morgan," he said with a momentary smile. "Her imperturbable efficiency was an office proverb." "Cut it out, Figgis. Off you go. Now, madam, I expect you know what I want. Our Manderson biography happens to be well up to date, replied Miss Morgan, drooping her dark eyelashes as she considered the position. I was looking over it only a few months ago. It's practically ready for tomorrow's paper. I should think the Sun had better use the sketch of his life they had about 2 years ago, when he went to Berlin and settled the potash difficulty. I remember it was a very good sketch, and they won't be able to carry much more than that. As for our paper, of course, we have a great quantity of cuttings, mostly rubbish. The sub-editors will have them as soon as they come in. Then we have two very good portraits that are our own property. The best is a drawing Mr. Trent made when they were both on the same ship somewhere. It's better than any of the photographs. But you say the public prefers a bad photograph to a good drawing. I'll send them down to you at once, and you can choose. As far as I can see, the Record is well ahead of the situation, except that you will not be able to get a special man down there in time to be of any use for tomorrow's paper. Sir James sighed deeply. What are we good for, anyhow? He inquired dejectedly of Mr. Silver, who had returned to his desk. She even knows Bradshaw by heart. Miss Morgan adjusted her cuffs with an air of patience. Is there anything else? She asked as the telephone bell rang. Yes, one thing, replied Sir James, as he took up the receiver. I want you to make a bad mistake sometime, Miss Morgan. An everlasting bloomer, just to put us in countenance. She permitted herself the fraction of what would have been a charming smile as she went out. Anthony, asked Sir James, and was at once deep in consultation with the editor on the other side of the road. He seldom entered the Sun building in person. The atmosphere of an evening paper, he would say, was all very well if you like that kind of thing. Mr. Anthony, the Murat of Fleet Street, who delighted in riding the whirlwind and fighting a tumultuous battle against time, would say the same of a morning paper. It was some 5 minutes later that a uniformed boy came in to say that Mr. Trent was on the wire. Sir James abruptly closed his talk with Mr. Anthony. They can put him through at once, he said to the boy. Hello, he cried into the telephone after a few moments. A voice in the instrument replied. Hello, be blowed. What do you want? This is Molloy, said Sir James. I know it is, the voice said. This is Trent. He's in the middle of painting a picture, and he's been interrupted at a critical moment. Well, I hope it's something important, that's all. Trent, said Sir James impressively, it is important. I want you to do some work for us. Some play, you mean, replied the voice. Believe me, I don't want a holiday. The working fit is very strong. I'm doing some really decent things. Why can't you leave a man alone? Something very serious has happened. What? Sigsbee Manderson has been murdered, shot through the brain, and they don't know who's done it. They found the body this morning. It happened at his place near Bishopsbridge. Sir James proceeded to tell his hearer, briefly and clearly, the facts that he'd communicated to Mr. Figgis. What do you think of it? He ended. A considering grunt was the only answer. Come now, urged Sir James. Tempter! You'll go down? There was a brief pause. Are you there? Said Sir James. Look here, Molloy, the voice broke out querulously. The thing may be a case for me, or it may not. We can't possibly tell. It may be a mystery. It may be as simple as bread and cheese. The body not being robbed looks interesting, but he may have been outed by some wretched tramp whom he found sleeping in the grounds and tried to kick out. It's the sort of thing he would do. Such a murderer might easily have sense enough to know that to leave the money and valuables was the safest thing. I tell you frankly, I wouldn't have a hand in hanging a poor devil who'd let daylight into a man like Sig Manderson as a measure of social protest. Sir James smiled at the telephone, a smile of success. Come, my boy, you're getting feeble. Admit, you want to go and have a look at the case. You know you do. If it's anything you don't want to handle, you're free to drop it. By the by, where are you?
I'm blown along a wandering wind, replied the voice irresolutely, and hollow, 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 all delight.
Can you get here within an hour? Persisted Sir James.
I suppose I can, the voice grumbled. How much time have I?
Good man. Well, there's time enough. That's just the worst of it. I've got to depend on our local correspondent for tonight. The only good train of the day went half an hour ago. The next is a slow one, leaving Paddington at midnight. You could have the Buster, if you like. Sir James referred to a very fast motor car of his. But you wouldn't get down in time to do anything tonight.
And I'd miss my sleep. No thanks. The train for me. I'm quite fond of railway traveling, you know. I have a gift for it. I'm the stoker and the stoked. I am the song the porter sings.
What's that you say?
That doesn't matter, said the voice sadly. I say, it continued, will your people look out a hotel near the scene of the action and telegraph for a room?
At once, said Sir James. Come here as soon as you can.
He replaced the receiver. As he turned to his papers again, a shrill outcry burst forth in the street below. He walked to the open window. A band of excited boys was rushing down the steps of the Sun Building and up the narrow thoroughfare toward Fleet Street. Each carried a bundle of newspapers and a large broadsheet with the simple legend, Murder of Sigsby Manderson. Sir James smiled and rattled the money in his pockets cheerfully. It makes a good bill, he observed to Mr. Silver, who stood at his elbow. Such was Manderson's epitaph.